fight? Why do I still write? Sometimes it's hard enough just dealing with real life. Sometimes I wanna jump on stage and just kill mics and show these people what my level of skill's like. But I'm still white. Sometimes I just hate life. Something ain't right. Hit the brake lights. Thanks to the stage fright.
Welcome once again to Command Line, the show that's one lucky radio station away from becoming, well, the nerdiest show on the radio. As always, I'm Lineman, and you may be wondering, well, how in the world did you get this recorded so quick? Because usually you like to take a couple months off there, huh, buddy? I started out wanting to do four segments for the first episode, end up with the four segments, and guess what? When you try to do a show about programming in an audio format, segments are pretty long. So we ended up splitting it into two episodes, and, well, hopefully, hint hint, we'll end up with some more submissions and I'll be able to do a show pretty quick. If that doesn't happen, then heaven forbid I'm going to have to record some of my own programming segments, and it might not be pretty. We've got quite a bit for this show, so I'm going to go ahead and cut to the chase. We're going to go to our friend Validus, and he's going to tell us a little bit about a functional language called Lisp.
Now some folks on the internet put their faith in C++. They swear that it's so powerful, it's what God used for us. And maybe it lets mortals dredge their objects from the sea.
Hello everybody, this is Validus from Lineman.net and TechDiscussions.com. In this segment for Command Line, I'm going to be introducing to you what might be a new language to some of you. If you've read any of my threads, you know I'm a functional language nut, and I'm going to be introducing what was perhaps the very first functional language, Lisp, and its dialect that's become more popular now, Scheme. For many of you, this will be a new programming experience. It differs from C or C++ or Visual Basic or any other language that you've probably used, unless, of course, you've used a functional language. Lisp was originally created by John McCarthy in 1960. McCarthy was an assistant professor at the MIT and started the MIT Artificial Intelligence Project with Dr. Minsky. At that time, the only high-level language to write in was Fortran, and the Fortran of the 1960s and late 50s was not the Fortran that you know today. It didn't even have conditional statements like the if or case statement that you might be familiar with in C. Dr. McCarthy decided that he needed a list processing language in order to help accomplish his AI research. At this time, AI research was mostly gaming. They had created in Fortran a system to do tree searches for chess programs. This was a very unwieldy program in Fortran, and it made use of a lot of list structures and tree structures. So McCarthy figured that a language that could process lists and have normal conditional statements and allow for recursion would be an ideal language candidate. So he invented what he called Lisp, or Lisp Processing Language. It's often, by many of its detractors, called lots of irritating single parentheses, because you'll see the format of Lisp has lots of irritating single parentheses all over the place. In fact, the biggest thing you should look for in a Lisp or a Scheme environment is some sort of IDE that will balance the parentheses for you. You can be frustrated debugging all day to find, you know, that the parentheses nesting structure was off. That's the basic history of how Lisp got started. It continued to develop through to 1984, when the ACM Symposium on Lisp and Functional Programming came up with what's now the standard Lisp implementation called Common Lisp. However, by this time, Lisp was almost entirely superseded by another language called Scheme. Scheme was basically a smaller dialect of Lisp created by Professor Guy Steele and Gerald Suzerman in 1975, who also worked at MIT. their language, initially called Schemer, was, you know, later tourniqueted to the name Scheme because you can only fit 6 characters in the file system used at MIT at the time. It was initially only used in the MIT labs, but it soon became adopted more widely throughout, you know, the AI world and eventually into the academic world. This was spurred on by the adoption of Scheme as the undergraduate language taught to all computer science majors at MIT, and was later basically adopted throughout the country. It's pretty hard to get through a computer science program today without being forced to learn a little bit of Scheme. Alright, enough of the boring history. I will get on to some examples of Lisp and Scheme and see why it's different from what you might already be using and what its power is and why it might not be it for you. First of all, you know, why is Lisp interesting? Like I said, it's a functional language, but it's not a purely functional language. Functional languages are often defined as having no side effects when you compute a function, just like in mathematics. You know, a function produces a single output. It doesn't affect the world in any other way. Lisp is not like this. Lisp actually can produce side effects, but Scheme is more functional. It still has these side effect producing things, but I'll avoid them in the examples I give today. So, first of all, Lisp is a functional language. Lisp was also the first language to allow conditional statements, namely the if. And most looping in Scheme is accomplished through recursion. Another interesting side note is Lisp was the first language to have garbage collection. There's no allocating of memory or deallocating of memory in Lisp, since the environment will take care of all of the allocation and deallocation of memory for you. Okay, I'm going to spend most of my examples on Scheme for several reasons. One, it's more commonly known, it's more commonly used now, and it's the one I know best. There are two environments that are widely available and commonly used for Scheme. The most official and probably most complete is MIT Scheme version 7.1. You can get this at www.swiss.ai.mit.edu/projects/scheme. While this is undoubtedly the most complete language, it's probably not the best for the beginner or the casual user. I would recommend using a program called Dr. Scheme. It's mainly an educational tool, but does have a complete, fully standardized Scheme environment in it. It has a really nice interface. It will balance parentheses for you. It has common sense error messages, and even has some sort of visual error messages where it will trace the functions that are incorrect or have incorrect variables. I would suggest getting this as your first Scheme environment. Both of these are free. You can get Dr. Scheme at www.cs.rice.edu/cs/plt. Just look for the link called Dr. Scheme. It's about an 8 meg download. Recommend installing it. It's really a very good environment. Alright. Scheme is built upon 3 major functions for Lisp processing called car, cooter, and cons. I'll get to these in the last example, but as you know, Scheme was developed out of Lisp, and thus Lisp processing is probably its most important function. These 3 functions combine with the conditional if statement and your normal logical operators and if equals and your arithmetic operators, plus, minus, division, whatnot, allow for you to do just about any computable problem. The format of Scheme is a little difficult to get a grasp of at first. The most non-obvious thing you'll find is the word lambda all over the place. This is derived from lambda calculus, which perhaps I'll do a segment on at some further time. But basic lambda calculus is not such a hard concept to understand. It was Alonzo Church who came up with what seems like the most simple idea, but logicians at the time hadn't really formalized it. It's the idea that a function need not be named any one specific name. For example, take the mathematical function, you know, f of x, where you know, x plus 1, essentially the successor function. Given 3, it returns 4. Given 4, it returns 5. You know, does the word f mean anything? No. The function g of x, where g equals x plus 1, is the same thing, as is foo of x, where x equals x plus 1, all the same function. So Church basically standardized this and to say that, you know, the generic symbol for a function is lambda. So in Scheme, you'll see lambda simply represents a function. This function is a nameless function. You'll also see the word define. Define is used to bind a name to a function. So we'll write now the very first program that you learn in any language, the Hello World program. In Scheme, you would write this as open parentheses define hello, open parentheses lambda write, open quotations hello world, close quotations, close parentheses, close parentheses. That would give the write command simply writes to the console whatever within the quotation mark that's in it next. Define defines, takes two arguments, hello and a function. One thing to note here is that Scheme is a postfix notation, which means instead of writing 1 plus 2 as 1 plus 2, you would write it as open parentheses plus 1, 2, close parentheses. This is the same as the HP calculators would use. Well, it's the reverse of it, but this is similar to what an HP calculator would use in reverse Polish notation, if you're familiar with that. It seems a little complicated at first, but you quickly get used to it. So, once again, we'll break down what this Hello World function does. The open parentheses is the big expression for the whole function. Define means the next thing will be the name. Hello is its name. The next open parentheses is the second argument to define. In this case, there's a lambda, which means it's some generic function. The contents of this function is the keyword write, which will write the next argument to the console, and within quotation marks, hello world is simply what you want written to the console. The two closing parentheses after this just balances the function, and that is the hello world function in Scheme. I'll now move on to an arithmetic expression that is written in Scheme. It's a little more complicated, a lot more parentheses, but quite simple to understand. We'll write a simple Fahrenheit to Celsius conversion program, since that seems to be a common example. It gives us a good understanding of the prefix operators, and it's not all that complicated. I will make the file available with all of this source on either my website or Lineman if he wishes to host it. Okay, you write this function the same way we start, open parentheses, define. Now, for the name of the function, we'll call this F2C. We will have another open parentheses, and we will write lambda. This is another anonymous function. This time we're going to give the function a parameter. So we have open parentheses, we'll call it ftemp, close parentheses. That's the parameter to the anonymous function. Now we'll write the formula. So we go open parentheses, asterisk, open parentheses, slash, the division sign, slash, 5, 9, close parentheses, open parentheses, minus, ftemp, 32, close parentheses, close parentheses, close parentheses, close parentheses. This will interpret the, you know, Fahrenheit to Celsius conversion program. When you basically have to see this typed out to get a good feel for it. But if you remember the formula for conversion of Fahrenheit to temperature, it's simply 5/9 times the Fahrenheit temperature minus 32. One nice thing about having prefix operators is you don't have to worry about order of operations. It's always performed in the proper order the way it's written. So the almost outer thing is the multiplication, and the first parameter to that is the division of 5 and 9, so it's 5/9 times. The second parameter is a subtraction of the ftemp and 32. So what it's saying is 5/9 times ftemp minus 32. And of course, all those stupid close parentheses at the end is just to balance it. So you get the idea why they started calling this lots of irritating single parentheses language. I will now introduce another simple program that will show you how we use recursion to do looping. One of the common Hello World type applications used in functional languages is the factorial, because it's a simple function and it uses recursion. I will now show you how to write the factorial function in Scheme. You'll probably guess the beginning parts because it's the same in just about every Scheme function. We have open parentheses, define, now the name of the function, we'll call it fact. Now the second argument to define will be the function. So we have open parentheses, once again we'll have a lambda because it's going to be some generic function, and we will have a argument to the function called x. So you have open parentheses, x, close parentheses. Now we'll see the condition statement for the first time. In Scheme, everything is prefix, so the condition statement might look a little different than what you're used to in C or C++. It will be an open parentheses if, and then the first argument to that will be the condition, the second argument to that will be the what to do if then, and then the third argument to that will be the else. So in this case, if we have if open parentheses equals x, 0. So what we're saying is if x equals 0, then the next argument is just 1, because in factorial, if x is 0, the output is 1. Else, if that's not true, we have open parentheses, multiplication, open parentheses, fact. Now, fact takes one argument, so we'll give it its argument. In this case, we want 1 less than x, so it's open parentheses minus x, 1. Close parentheses, close parentheses. So that's the first argument to the multiplication. The second argument to the multiplication is simply x. Then we close parentheses on that, and that closes the scope for the multiplication. Close parentheses, the scope for the if, close parentheses for the lambda, and close parentheses for the define, and we now have a working factorial function. Let's see. That is the basics of how you write loops in Scheme. It's done basically entirely through recursion. I am going to give you now an example. I will go through it relatively quickly because I don't think explaining it without you actually looking at it will give you much of a benefit. But it will show you a very basics of how to use Carcuter and cons to manipulate lists. If you take, this is a real simple function to simply search a list to see if something exists in it. Before I do this, let me explain what Carcuter and cons are. These are the minimal functions you have to write list operating programs. What car does is it returns the first element of a list. So if you were to say car 1, 2, 3, it would return 1. And Cuter returns all but the first element of the list. So once again, Cuter on 1, 2, 3 would return the list 2, 3. And cons, which stands for concatenate, does what you might expect. It takes two lists and returns a concatenated list. So if you were to give it cons list 1, 2 and list 3, 4, it would return list 1, 2, 3, 4. With these three simple functions, you can actually do just about anything you need to do on lists. Alright, I'm going to now show you how to write the simple search function in Scheme using the list operators car and Cuter. Once again, you start the function like you would expect by opening parentheses, the word define, the name of the function, in this case we're going to call it search, and a lambda function. So open parentheses lambda. This time there'll be two arguments, both the list and the element you're searching for. So after the lambda, you want open parentheses, we'll call it L for the list, space x, and close parentheses. So L is the list and x is the value you're searching for. Now we're going to use another conditional if statement like you'd expect. So open parentheses if. Now the first element is the conditional statement. So what we want to say is the first element of the list what you're looking for? So we do that by going open parentheses equals open parentheses car L X close parentheses. What this means is saying, you know, is the car of L equal to X? If that's the case, we found X and we can quit. So the then condition on that is just a write found. If that's not the case, then we have to go and search the list further. To do this, we have to do another if condition, because if the list were to be empty and we were to go into it again, it wouldn't know what to do. So we go open parentheses if. Now there's a new keyword called null question mark. What null question mark does is it returns true or false depending on if the list it's given is null, which meaning empty or not. So we go open parentheses null question mark cooter L close parentheses close parentheses. What this is saying is the cooter of L null, which means is the list without the first element on it empty? If so, we've reached the end of the list and we haven't found what we're looking for, so we write not found. Just after that, the then condition, if that null is true, the then condition is open parentheses, write not found, close parentheses. Else, which means it's not true that the null of cooter L was true, which means that there is something beyond the first element. We don't have a single element in our list. We want to search again with the cooter of L, which means we want to knock the top of the list off and search again recursively. So the else condition on this last if is open parentheses search, open parentheses cooter L close parentheses X close parentheses. Remember that this function takes two variables. So when we call search, we give it the cooter of L, so we give it the list minus the first element, and we give it X, because what we're looking for hasn't changed. We close parentheses on that, closes the search. Close parentheses on that, closes the last if. Close parentheses on that, closes the first if. Close parentheses, closes the lambda. Close parentheses, closes the define, and we have written a simple search function in Scheme. I wish I could go on about this, and I could for hours, but you probably don't want to listen to an entire lecture on Scheme in this little segment. I think I've given you enough to go off on your own, and I think you should now be able to pick up any tutorial or book on Scheme and learn more if you're interested. Or you perhaps have learned that Scheme is definitely not something you're interested in, and you never want to look at it again. Either way, I hope I've shown you a little bit about a new language, and perhaps you've enjoyed this segment. If you would like to learn any other specific languages, let me know. Or if you want to know, you know, something in the next segment about something more theoretical, I'd definitely be happy to do that too. Maybe we could go deeper into what lambda calculus is and why there are these lambdas scattered throughout Scheme and why this is theoretically important. Anyway, I will close this off and send it back to Lineman.
So he wrote it all in lists.
Thank you, Validus, and we'll be right back after this.
Are you frustrated with Microsoft Internet Explorer?
Yeah.
Are you fed up with annoying spyware and non-stop pop-up ads?
Don't like jerks sneaking in on my privacy.
Are you sick and tired of bugs that allow arbitrary code to be executed on your system?
Hey, I've had it up to here with this.
Are you aware that the Department of Homeland Security recently advised users to stop using Internet Explorer due to security issues?
Did you see the memo about this?
There is an alternative. Introducing Mozilla Firefox. With the Mozilla Firefox web browser, you'll enjoy features like integrated pop-up blocking, tabbed browsing, Google search built right into the toolbar, compliance with HTML standards, enhanced privacy and security controls, and much, much more.
Impressive.
How much would you expect to pay for this amazing software? $99? $49? Maybe $19.95?
No.
Mozilla Firefox is available for the low, low price of $0. That's right, one easy payment of $0.00. So head on over to Mozilla.org and download your free copy of the Firefox browser today. That's Mozilla.org. See for yourself what everyone's talking about, and take back the web with Mozilla Firefox, the browser, reloaded.
And welcome back. Now, I've got to admit, this next segment really takes me back and kind of makes me look at the way that we program and the way we teach each other to program. In the sense that, well, like all decent, hardworking programmers out there, I realize you're not supposed to use global variables. And if you don't understand why that is, then there's actually several good reasons, and I'll let you talk about that with other people, or you can come ask at techdiscussions.com and see how many different answers you get. Well, anyway, I realize you're not supposed to do that, but a lot of us start out when we're programming, especially in some, well, I'll say it, crappy language like BASIC, that you'll start out, you'll use global variables, it's the first thing you learn to do, it's easy, and it's readable. Well, and I don't know how many times I've heard the arguments in class or seen it on the internet, well, I want to do it that way, it's easier to understand. That may be, but it's not the best way. On the other hand, this whole segment that Coldrink does kind of reminds me of how that really is easier, and of course he isn't advocating using global variables, but the way that he describes what he calls self-documenting code really reminds me of that. It's much more readable, and you don't have to be a programmer to understand it so much. So without further ado, here's Coldrink and self-documenting code.
Hello everybody, Coldrink here. As you may or may not know, I have a little content management system project that I've been working on for quite a while called the Alight PHP Content Management System. Not very well named, but it's grown into something that I think is becoming really great. Originally it was really small and it was more of just a collection of forms and some very light duty processing. It really wasn't anything that you could even consider a content management system, but since then it's grown a lot and it's really been experiencing a lot of growing pains. I've gone back over the past few months and I've done a lot of updating and a lot of code changes, and it's been really difficult to see what I was trying to do with any given piece of code. It was difficult for me to understand the mindset I had when I wrote something or when I named a variable a certain way. And this time, in this update, what I'm doing is rewriting a good bit of the software to kind of take care of a lot of those problems, because as the software expands in the future, I want it to be easy and I want anyone to be able to go in there and make the changes they see fit. So what I'm going to talk to you today about is how to write code that is pretty much self-documenting. We're going to learn how to do a few things that will make it easier for you to understand code when you go back and see it, as well as make it easier for anyone else who reviews your code to understand what you're doing. This is really ideal if you're going to be working on any type of collaborative project. It's kind of a waste of time for several different people to go out and write their areas of the program and then have to just go back and talk to each other constantly about what someone intended to do. They say, hey, what the hell are you trying to do with this function? It doesn't make any sense. So this is really going to be something that's going to make you more productive at work, and it's going to make things a lot easier for you and your own personal projects as well. The most important thing to consider when writing code that is mostly self-documenting is identifier names. When you name a variable, you're usually thinking of something in the short term. In most functions, you'll have one variable that you use for a few lines and then you get rid of it. So it's really easy to just name something like the iterator. If you're using an index iterator in a loop, it's really easy just to name it I. That's something that people have been doing a long time, and examples they use for for loops, they'll loop over an integer named I and maybe another one named j. And that really doesn't say much. You can go back in a couple of weeks and see, okay, well, I've got this loop with this integer I, but you know, what is it for? And you'd have to look at the different lines, see the context in which it's used, and eventually you'll figure out exactly what you're trying to do with it. Even some people will just use index, which is pretty much what it stands for if you're looping over the elements of an array or something similar. And even then, it's a little bit vague. I mean, how many indexes are you going to use? So if you name things carefully, you can immediately understand what any given variable is for. For instance, if you are looping over an array that carries people's names, instead of naming the variable I, name it people's names index. And that may sound a little bit awkward, but you always know exactly what that's for. You'll know that it's meant to be used with an array called people's names. That way, should you go back and use it at any other point, you don't have to scroll around and search through your code and try and figure out when you first declared it and what were your initial intentions for the variable. You'll just know right away. When you're naming arrays or any type of array object like a collection, you can do something a little bit similar. Instead of having an array called names, do people's names. That way you'll know that they're names of people and not just some random files or any other thing your program might deal with. And it's a good idea also to end your array variables, your array identifier names, with S's. Make them plural, because you are talking about multiple items. If you pull records from a file, instead of naming the variable that everything is stored in, file, name it records. You'll know that there's multiple variables there, as well as the fact that it's an array. And if you stay consistent with this, at any given time, you'll know exactly what you should be doing with any given variable. You should also be really careful when naming your functions. If you have a function that's named retract, well, how's anybody supposed to know what that does? I mean, yeah, maybe it'll retract, but what? You should try and always use both a verb and a noun. That way, you can immediately understand the purpose of the function. Instead of retract, calling a function retract article would make it very self-explanatory. The function will retract an article. If it's get views, you know that the function should return the number of views for whatever it is you're working with. You don't have to look back and see what calls the function or look through the code of the function to see what it does to figure out its intended purpose. It becomes obvious to you. There are also some things that don't really deal with identifier names that you can do to make your programs a lot easier to understand. Well, your code. One thing you can do is alter your function structure a little bit. When using Boolean tests like if statements, what most people will do is test for a true value. And that just kind of makes sense. If you want to see if a person is an administrator, you'll check to see if they're an administrator. What may be helpful is to check to see if they're not an administrator. If you want things to be efficient, you should probably check the most common cases first, but there are always exceptions to every rule. Testing for a negative value can make your code so much easier to write and understand that it may be worth the performance hit. And we're talking about a performance hit that's so small, you're probably not going to notice anyway, unless you're doing thousands of calculations. This is something I've done in my project, and it's been very helpful. I've tested for negative values first that would produce an error condition. This way, when I have an error or when my functions report an error, I can see the exact line. If I do a negative test at line 50, if I have the error reporting code on line 51, it's really easy for me to find the exact spot where the error occurred. But if you're using if statements that have 100 lines of code in them, and your error is down at the bottom, you've suddenly got to scroll up through 100 lines of code keeping track of opening and closing braces to find the matching if statement. Plus, if you have error functions that report the line number that the error occurred on, like mine do, that's completely useless if you're 100 lines away. By having the very first line of code after a Boolean test be one that reports the error, you can use macros like PHP underscore underscore line underscore underscore is the current line. In my functions, I can use that minus one, and when I get an error reported, I'll know the exact line that the test failed on. I don't have to scroll around at all. I don't have to think about it or look through my code. It may only save a few seconds of time, but when you consider the hundreds of hours involved developing something, or even thousands of hours, depending on the size of the project, a few seconds here and there can mean a lot of extra work. You can get done a lot quicker and a lot more efficiently. Another thing that I would recommend doing is having a variable local to all functions that contains the name of the function and the arguments passed. This is something that I have found incredibly useful. By doing this, it'll allow you to pass data off to an error handling function that can report the function name, the passed arguments, and the line numbers where an error occurred. It's very similar to a traceback, and if you have an error in Java, if you have a fatal error in a Java program, you'll be able to look at your error output and see a whole list of the failed functions and what was passed to them. And you might be able to easily identify where the problem went wrong, because you'll see what data is being passed to the functions, and by looking at your code, you'll know what should be passed to the function. That way you'll see that maybe the first argument to a function is empty, and it shouldn't be. You can go back to the function that called that function and know that either your variables didn't get initialized or you didn't pass the right variable. It can save you so much time because you're not going to be searching around looking for something that you could have found in a matter of seconds if you planned things out properly from the beginning. Of course, everyone's programming style is a little bit different, and every project has different standards set by the project leaders. But using some variations of these things I've just mentioned to you, you should be able to write code that is easily understood by just about anybody. If it's just not your style and it's not going to work with you, don't bother. As much as I encourage everyone to write easy to understand code, what it comes down to is making it easier for the programmer. And if it's not easy for you, there's really just no point. If that's the case, just play around and try and find different ways that you can make your code easy for you and for others to decipher. It'll save you a lot of time, and anyone who uses your code will greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Drink. And that's going to wrap things up for this time. But before we go, I want to mention something since we've been... I'm starting to find that this show and some of the others is getting mirrored in different places on the internet, which is a pretty cool thing to see. Somebody likes it enough to, you know, actually share it. I do want to mention that the sites, the main sites for those of us who record this, are lineman.net and techdiscussions.com. Now, I realize that that should be really, really simple to figure out. You know, at least the lineman part, you ought to be able to narrow that down to two or three sites to try out. But you'd actually be surprised. As a webmaster, I get reports from Webalizer that'll show me what search engine searches are and what phrases are being used that are resulting in my site. One of my favorites that I get to see is a search that'll be something like Lyman and Cold Drink Site or Lyman and Cold Drink Message Boards. You know, I don't know how hard it is to figure out Lyman, and it's not like we don't promote ourselves enough that everybody should be able to find us. But just in case you can't, it's lyman.net, techdiscussions.com, and, well, another site we work on is seccomgroup.com, seccomgroup.com. Well, once again, I want to thank you for listening, and I appreciate it. And let us know at the sites. I won't say them again. Let us know if there's any segment you'd like to submit or you have any ideas for segments, something you want to learn about. There's a lot of knowledge about a lot of programming contained on, you know, in those members of those sites. So please be sure to let us know if there's anything we can do. So thanks for listening, and I'll see you on the forums.